Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. Today's show is full of people and their passions. In some cases, their passions are for the birds. In the second half of the show, we hear from our wildlife correspondent, Pat Schlarbaum, whose passion for big native birds in Iowa has him robbing the osprey nests of Minnesota. Then Nevada poet Jennifer L. Knox is hoping to foster passion and interest for Iowa's native birds with a crowdsourced poetry project, Bird of Mouth, a project that anyone can be part of. Stay tuned and find out what that's about. And what's up with this Pokemon craze? Thankfully, we have young people on staff now, or at least on internship, to sort that out for us here at KHOI. Intern Isaac Beal will be on that beat. But let's start with the passion for life itself. This is the reason one Boone woman, Danielle Worth, described for attending a talk by Des Moines Waterworks Director Bill Stowe on Monday evening at the Ames Public Library. Well over 100 people were in attendance, requiring a change of rooms. It seemed that even a PowerPoint presentation, when given by this rock star of Iowa's environmental movement, is a can't-miss event. As our listeners must know by now, Bill Stowe and his board at the Des Moines Waterworks are suing Calhoun, Sac, and Buena Vista counties to the north and west of us, where extremely high loads of nitrate were measured exiting drainage tile into the waters of Iowa. Mr. Stowe wanted his audience to come away with two words from his talk: agricultural accountability.
We've sued three upstream counties. We sued their boards of supervisors because they are responsible for overseeing these drainage districts. Mm-hmm. And the drainage districts, for the most part, have been around for 100 years plus. They were constructed to move water away. A lot has changed in 100 years. The industrial model for agriculture has changed, but also the science. Just moving that water is not what happens. It moves water and pollutants downstream to us, and we're asking for agricultural accountability through those drainage districts to get a permit to be able to discharge into the waters of the state, just like any other business does. Pretty controversial, as you can imagine. I can show a bunch of numbers to you that talks about how trends are establishing that nitrate continues to be a huge problem. And, averages, I'm struck by the idea that if I put my feet into the freezer of my stand-up refrigerator and my head into the oven, on average, I should be comfortable. In my business, we don't deal with averages. We deal with extremes, because you are thirsty on a really hot and humid day, and we can't say, no water. We have to build our systems for those kind of peaks. And unfortunately, the kind of pollutants we're seeing, the nitrate concentrations and loadings, are pretty extraordinary.
And there in that clip, you can hear Bill Stowe's penchant for similes, which made his talk so entertaining. In another simile, he compared the nitrate removal systems, huge white tanks he described to be as large as the library's main meeting room where we were. He compared it to a rusty 1970s Vega. This because a salt slurry is used in the process of denitrification using ionization as they do it now. And one of the questions that came up, what are you doing with the nitrogen you remove? The Farm Bureau has tried to disparage Stowe for his practice of dumping it back into the river. And this, was his only option until, as he describes it, his organization decided to build a long pipe to run this residue to the waste treatment plant of Des Moines, where there are biological and not just chemical mechanisms to remove the nitrogen and turn it into nitrogen gas. The cost of this pipe is assumed by his ratepayers, and this type of cost was another point that he made.
The producer should pay, in my view, for a cost of production. There's an externality now. You raise corn, you raise hogs. There's an environmental cost that's being pushed down to the consumers that I represent that has to be internalized, not only because of good economics, but sustainability issues. If you don't have markets that have adequate knowledge of what things cost, and other people are paying your externalities, There are environmental consequences and economic consequences from doing that. It is expensive. But I'll tell you, I work for the steel and the oil businesses and coal businesses, not a lot of the dirty things. You know what? Nobody asked my employer, Royal Dutch Shell, who was going to pay to clean up what they were emitting into the air. Their shareholders did it. That was their responsibility. That's a cost of doing business, a cost of raising hogs or raising corn when you're throwing nitrate or microcystins or some kind of toxin into the waters that the state is cleaning it up. Frankly, what it costs certainly is something that gets to, should there be public money to try and deal with it, in addition to private dollars. That's a public policy question. It will be expensive, but travel north of here. Go to Minnesota. Go to Wisconsin, states that have a pretty rich agricultural background also, but would never let Harry the Hereford, as an example, hang out until he or she relieves her or himself in a waterway. I know a lot of things that we could be doing that don't cost a whole lot of money. That's our basic responsibility.
Yes, Harry the Hereford was one of the slides that Bill Stowe showed. It was a cow standing in the middle of the water, standing in a stream. And he made the point that in Iowa there are no laws against cattle having access to the waterways. Another example would be that there are no mandatory buffers between the edge of a farm field and a stream. So those are the no-cost things that he was talking about that might help significantly with this problem of impaired waters. He showed a few maps of Iowa and kind of got us to recognize really that the kind of place that we live in here in the Des Moines Lobe, where the glaciers have pushed down this very rich soil. And so let's listen to him talk about the necessity of drainage tile, which is the issue here in this region, central Iowa.
Central Iowa is unique. These areas called the Des Moines-Raccoon River really are different. The soils, glaciation about 15,000 years ago, not very long ago by glaciation standards, comes down through Minnesota, brings this rich, beautiful soil that we love so much here in central Iowa. The glaciers actually stop in Polk County. Our Capitol Hill is at one of the terminal moraine, the points of those glacial movements. But from here north, in the Raccoon and Des Moines River valleys, those soils, that beautiful black soil, isn't productive for raising corn in particular unless it's drained. So we have a whole lot of drainage tile here. Some of you who maybe in Johnson County or Pottawatomie County or Osceola County or Fayette County, not much drainage systems necessary in those soils and those topographies, but very important here. There we got some. There's some drainage tile that's being laid. You see the wonderful inset on the left, the beautiful corn that's emerging in black soil, but about a meter beneath that soil is this flexible tile, not really tile anymore, more like flexible hose, that artificially, instead of letting that water and chemicals go through the biosphere down into the soil mantle, it shunted off into the waters of the state, taking more water more quickly and with more pollution to those of us downstream. And unfortunately, huge consequences from that. Here's where the drainage districts are in Iowa. I talked about how we were so unique in the Des Moines and Raccoon River. Drainage districts are the political entities that are formed to be able to put public system and tying it to private systems to let those farmlands drain. It's almost all right here in central Iowa from here north, because it's what's necessary to be able to drain that land.
And here in Story County, we have dozens of drainage districts that are looked over by the supervisors. Well, in the question and answer period, Stowe was asked what his purpose was in filing the lawsuit, and he came back again to this concept of agricultural accountability.
Our end game is agricultural accountability. We think that comes by having those permits on each of those drainage districts, just like a municipal storm system does here in Ames, or a wastewater treatment plant in Des Moines. You're discharging into the waters of the state, then you're responsible. What it will mean is, realistically, that those boards of supervisors will say, whoa, we better be thinking about drainage management issues, about land management issues.
Yes, so the county supervisors, and particularly county supervisors in central Iowa, where these extensive networks of drainage districts are concentrated, will play a huge role in this discussion and any outcome of this lawsuit. In fact, Story County Supervisor Rick Sanders was present at the talk. He scooted out before I could ask him what he thought of it. Any of you who happened to run into Mr. Sanders, please ask him what he thought of Bill Stowe's presentation on Monday night. I would note that in the League of Women Voters debate between the candidates in the Democratic primary for supervisor, we at KHOI put this debate on our website. This was one of the key differences between the two Democratic candidates, with Reno Berg saying he thought the lawsuit was the wrong approach, and the victor of that matchup, Loris Olson, saying that she saw the need for supervisors to move beyond what they now see as their current responsibilities and take action on conservation. So that the voters might have a feeling for this that politicians should take notice of. Loris Olson, Linda Merkin, and Martin Chitty, all of them contenders for the two open supervisor seat, were all at the meeting. Now, most of the discussion so far has involved row crops, soy, and corn, but animal confinements and feedlots are also a huge source of nitrates. And in fact, Stowe had a map of the feedlots in the state, and the two counties north of us, Hamilton and Hardin, are the most densely populated with confinement operations. Out in the northwest, of course, we have quite a few cattle feedlots. But Ames resident Susie Petra brought up the idea of a hog confinement moratorium. Last week on Local Talk, we were discussing Prestige Farms, the huge hog factory farm outfit out of North Carolina, a state that decided in 2007 to impose a moratorium on new hog confinements. Well, what about Iowa? Iowa has more hogs than North Carolina. The numbers Bill Stowe was using was 7 hogs for every person, 21 million hogs, 3 million people in the state of Iowa. The state, he says, is reaching our saturation point of hogs. And this is going to be, it turns out, the battle cry of Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, the group that brought Bill Stowe to Ames on Monday. Here's Evan Berger. He's a native of the Slater, Iowa area and an organizer for ICCI, talking up this issue.
You know, this idea of a factory farm moratorium, you know, to me, it's common sense. We got way too many of these things. Like Susie said, almost 10,000 factory farms across the state. We saw the map up there. We got too many factory farms already. We got too much manure. We have too much nitrates. We don't know what to do with it. We need to take a break and figure out what to do with all that pollution. But this is a bold idea. It's going to take, you know, we got 100-something people in the room tonight. That's awesome. It's a huge turnout. We need a heck of a lot more people. So over the next 2 years, we're going to be holding meetings like this all across the state. So who can tell me what big event in the political sphere is happening here in Iowa in 2018? Well, I think I heard there's a governor's election. That's exactly right. So, you know, we know that even if we manage to get a moratorium bill through the House, the state House, the state Senate, we know that the governor who's currently in office would veto it. Right? So over the next 2 years, we're going to be changing the debate even more and bringing up this issue of a moratorium, so much so that in 2018, any serious candidate who wants to run for governor needs to take that into account. They need to take a position on that. All right. Yeah.
Once again, that's Story County native Evan Berger from ICCI rousing folks to action after a very interesting and entertaining talk by Des Moines Waterworks Director Bill Stowe at the Ames Public Library on Monday evening. You're listening to Local Talk. I'm Greta Anderson, and joining me is one of our summer interns, Isaac Beal. Hello, Isaac.
Hi, Greta. Good morning.
Well, we've just been talking about the need to understand what kind of place we live in, to localize our understanding of the world. Isaac's going to tell us about a new phenomenon that, well, does it do that? Does it help us localize our situation?
I think so. I mean, I think definitely Pokemon Go is teaching people about the area that they live in through playing a video game on your phone.
Okay, well, tell me, what is this phenomenon? I don't know a thing about it.
All right, well, Pokemon Go was developed by Niantic, which is an American software development company based in San Francisco. And the game first came out in Australia on July 6th, and then it came out a couple days later here in the U.S., so we weren't the first ones to get it. But the game's mapping system that they use is based on Google Earth, and Niantic was actually, it used to be part of Google before they split up, so they're already familiar with the software, so they kind of had a base off of what to do. 5 years ago, Niantic had an earlier game that was similar to Pokemon Go called Ingress, which is another augmented reality game. So they would have certain locations set up like Pokemon Go does, where people would have to go, and they would have to like set up portals or whatever, and the portals were based off of like historical significant areas and things like that. So when they developed Pokemon Go, they used a lot of those popular stops to be Pokestops in the game.
Pokestops?
Yes, Pokestops are. So.
And we have a Pokestop right outside our station.
That's right. So we have a Pokestop right outside our station here, or, well, a gym, actually. But then there's Pokestops all downtown around Main Street area. And Pokestops are, you pretty much walk by, and if you need, like, it's how you pick up items. So there's Pokeballs to get potions, eggs, different things that you need to play the game, basically, is how you, like, replenish your stock. And each one, like, if you click on it, it says where it is, so you learn something new. Like, there's one at the First House of Ames just right down the road, and there's one at the Ames Public Library and things like that. And then the gyms, which is what we have located right outside our building, is how you can get extra, like, experience points by battling a gym. And it's pretty much, there's three different teams, and you battle for which team owns it. Different kids will come out here, I've seen, play, and they sit on the benches to come and try and take it over. So 5 minutes, it'll be Team Yellow owns the gym, and then 5 minutes later, there'll be Team Blue on it. So it's a pretty fast-changing game. It's funny to see all the kids who come down here and try to take it over during the day.
And every so often, you hear one of them turn around and say, oh, this is a radio station.
Yeah, they don't know yet, but now they're starting to figure it out, I guess. So that's good.
Yeah. But this one is actually technically associated with the Historical Society.
Yeah, that's what it
says.
Our
next door neighbor.
Mm-hmm, but I can reach it from inside the studio, and so it's pretty much connected with us. And that's why they use the benches outside, because they can take a break while they're actually doing it. So it makes it easier for them.
Okay. So have you played this a lot, Isaac?
Oh, yeah. I've been playing it. It's not as much as some people, but I try to, yeah. It's pretty fun. So basically, the main goal of the game is to catch all the Pokemon, like it says in, like, the song, catch them all.
A Pokemon is like a creature?
Yeah, kind of like an animal, sort of. There's ones that look like birds. There's one that looks like bugs. There's, like, rock Pokemon, water Pokemon, a bunch of different types. So they're kind of like little creatures or little monsters, however you would look at it.
So that's the wildlife of the Pokemon world,
yes.
And people are trying to catch it?
Yeah, so based off the TV show, the main character would try to catch all these Pokemon, and that's what you're trying to do. Each Pokemon you catch gives you level up or XP for you to level up your character, and you can catch multiple ones to evolve that Pokemon into its next stage so they can grow and things like that, and they're put up around based on location, so in, like, high-populated areas like the downtown, you're going to see more different types of Pokemon than you might in, like, an urban area where it's just, like, a neighborhood. And then by water, you'll find water Pokemon and things like that. And I've read online that they say fire Pokemon are supposed to be by gas stations and things like that. I'm not sure how much truth is to that, but that's
Pokemon?
What they say. Yeah, I'm not sure. But so there's different Pokemon based,
like,
all over.
That's so interesting that people can actually become aware that, oh, I might be near a stream, mm-hmm. where they wouldn't know that normally.
Yeah, I know. So, like, on campus, Lake Laverne, people are there all day, all night. Like, that's, like, the big spot because there's, like, three Pokestops right there, and everyone's just sitting there trying to catch Pokemon walking around the lake or just all through campus, basically. So that's pretty funny to see. It's created kind of this whole movement, I feel like. There's just people doing it all the time.
Well, and it says so much about the state of our culture that, you know, it requires this simulation game mm-hmm. to allow people to experience their surroundings.
Yeah, to get outside and actually, like, do something. I think it's cool, though, because you can use the camera so you can see the Pokemon, like, in the world, like, that you would see. So you turn your camera on and Pokemon will pop up and say, like, you're in front of the Campanile. The Pokemon will be right in front of the Campanile, and you can see it there and try to catch it. So that's what makes it also cool, is, like, it's being put into your reality.
Oh, okay. That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you talked to somebody, didn't you?
Yeah.
Who has a lot of Pokemon Go experience,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, he plays all the time. He's a pretty big fan of the game and has been since he's grown up. His name's Tate Huckstadt. He's a communication studies major at Iowa State, avid Pokemon Go player, and he gave some really good insight into what it's like to be a player in the game. So, you have Pokemon Go. Did you play, like, the original Pokemon video games, like on Game Boys and stuff, or is this your first time?
Yep. Pokemon was my first Game Boy game I ever had. I got it on Christmas with my Game Boy Color. I had Pokemon Blue and Pokemon nice. Yellow, not realizing that they were pretty much the same thing.
So what's it like now to play this kind of game just straight from your phone? Like, what's the differences to you, and, like, what does it mean?
It feels really, in a way, it feels more adult because, you know, you have this more powerful device that's capable of contacting everyone you know and bringing information at your fingertips. So it feels, that's a different feel definitely there, but it's just, it's a lot more convenient, you know, it's a lot more integrated with the life, it feels like. So it's just, you know, kind of a double-edged blade, could be bad or good, because
right.
It just feels like sometimes I get on Pokemon Go app when I didn't even intend to.
Yeah. So what do you think for, like, the younger kids? This is might be their, like, first Pokemon game. Do you think that this will start a whole new generation of Pokemon video game fans and it'll continue to progress?
I could definitely see people enjoying Pokemon Go, but not actually enjoying the traditional Pokemon games, even the ones that they're continuing to release, since they're more, you know, closer to traditional RPGs than mm-hmm. Pokemon Go is, where it's very casual, very action-oriented game rather than turn-based. So I could see it bringing fans to the franchise, but I could also see it not having that big of an impact.
Right. So what's your favorite part of Pokemon Go?
I think the fact that it's so social is my favorite part. It's just great to go out with your friends and just go on a poke walk, as we call them, and just, you know, go around campus, which or downtown, which are my two favorite areas and aims to hit, and just getting whatever Pokemon. And, you know, you always have a little bit of a rivalry going with your friends, just because when you're trying to catch rare Pokemon, it seems that there's always someone in the group who doesn't manage to catch it.
Or someone has it and you don't, and you're just mad about it.
Yeah.
Have you met a lot of people, like, playing it?
I haven't really, like, made any friends, but I've talked to people out that were, like, you know, strangers, just casual, friendly conversations about the game that I knew I would have never talked to those people if it weren't for the game, so I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, because just driving around, like, any part of the, like, Ames, really, you see people playing it all over. Where do you see, like, people playing the most?
Oh, I've seen tons of people playing on campus and downtown at all hours of the day and night. One night, I was out at 2:30 in downtown, and two guys put lures down on the there's three Pokestops that are in very close proximity to each other, and it was 2:30 and they were out there.
Oh my god, that's funny.
I was too, so.
Nice. Where's, like, the craziest place or the funniest place you've seen, like, a Pokemon that you've caught?
I don't know. I haven't had really any crazy or funny ones, none that were meme-worthy, like the ones I've seen online at least, but I don't know. I always think it's funny to go down by the lake and just hear everybody shouting about which Pokemon show up.
Yeah. Do you think it's interesting, like, the Pokestops around Ames? Because when I've played, I've noticed that, like, there's things in Ames that I didn't know, like, were things, but since they're Pokestops, I, like, went to them, and then I knew that this was, like, had significance to the town or whatever.
Yeah, I definitely feel that way, too. I haven't really gone to any, like, remote locations. I've mostly stuck to areas that I'm pretty familiar with, but, you know, it definitely makes you notice things again that you hadn't really thought about in a while.
Do you think this game is going to be, like, revolutionary-wise, not just for, like, Pokemon franchise, but for other games that people might make on phones or, like, handheld devices?
I think it'll definitely start a trend. I mean, anything that causes this big of a cultural phenomenon is definitely going to inspire people to try to follow in its footsteps or improve upon it, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing there will be a lot of, you know, mediocre things trying to use the formula, but I'm guessing there will also be some innovators who are, you know, trying to push the boundaries even farther than games like Pokemon Go have.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to see, or like, what updates would you like to see the game make in the future if they do make updates, or what would you like changed?
I'd like to see more social features. As of right now, the game doesn't have any sort of friends feature or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, personally, I'd like to be able to see, you know, what my friends have been up to in Pokemon Go, as long as they're willing to share that information, you know. Mm-hmm. I could see also a lot of ways that that would go wrong, so I'm not surprised that they left it out of the game for the to start things off. I know that Nintendo has traditionally been a lot more cautious with online interactions with strangers than other video game companies have, since they're normally trying to play to more of a family or younger audience, you know, with including the regular gamer audience.
Do you think that they'll ever implement, like, a multiplayer system where you can battle each other?
I really hope that'll come out, too. Yeah, that would be great. I'd like to just, you know, be able to battle against my friends.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they have that up their sleeves, even, because it seems like the gym experience right now isn't really made for that type of expansion, you know, since...
Yeah, that's true.
You're just tapping away at the gyms. That's probably one of my only complaints about the games, is the gym battles feel quite lackluster.
Yeah,
like, it doesn't feel like there's much strategy to it.
Well, you just... Like, basically, you just move your finger around and dodge, and then that's pretty much all you do.
Most of the time, I just tap away, though, and don't even hassle with the dodging.
Right. I know, like, I was reading online that the gyms were made so, like, you could attack them with friends, because, like, people with higher levels will be owning the gyms. Have you, like, gone out with, like, a group of friends as a team to try to beat a gym, or do you just mainly do it solo?
A lot of the times when I'm doing gyms, it will be with other people. Mm-hmm. It's funny because you'll see your Pokemon there attacking, and then you look across the way on the other side of the Pokemon you're attacking. It's like in the center of the arena, and mm-hmm. you'll see like another person over on the other side. I don't know. It seems like it only works some of the time that way, but when it does, it's pretty funny, and you defeat the gyms pretty quickly.
Yeah, I've never done it or fought a gym with other people yet, so I was wondering how that works. That's kind of interesting. I didn't know if you would actually see what was happening or not, so that's pretty cool.
You don't really see what's happening, like, but you'll see, that they're there across the way.
You know that they're helping you out.
Yeah.
Do you own a lot of gyms around?
Actually, not right now. I kind of make brief appearances at gyms, but, you know, being Team Instinct, we don't really have we don't really have control over much turf and names.
It seems like that there's a big turnover of gyms, like, every 5 minutes.
Yeah. Like, Parks Library is a war zone.
Yeah. There's one that's, like, at the Ames Historical Society, like, right here, and I can, like, reach from here. One day I went in and I took over the gym. I was like, all right, I'm on here. And then, like, 5 minutes later, these kids sit down out there, and I my Pokemon just died. And, like, I saw that they took it over. So it just seems like it's a pretty fast-paced game, and people are constantly playing it.
And that was our KHOI intern, Isaac Beal, speaking with Tate Huckstadt, a... ISU student who plays Pokemon Go.
Yep, avid Pokemon Go player. He's a communication studies major as well.
Okay. And as we were listening to Tate, our engineer, Jonah DeGeest, was actually catching him some Pokemon.
I actually caught two Pokemon over the course of that recording. One showed up on the couch. It was a Pidgeotto. And then actually The other one was just like a Pidgey, and it showed up right in front of me on the soundboard. So I thought it was pretty cool.
Sweet. A Pidgey. Now, are those birds?
Yes.
And a Pidgeotto is also a bird?
It's an evolved Pidgey. Oh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Okay. Well, we've got creatures and we've got creatures. With us in the studio is our wildlife correspondent, Pat Schlarbaum. Pat, you've been catching some creatures yourself.
Yeah, thank you, Greta. We have embarked on our 18th year of ospreys to Iowa. It's something that's been kind of a long-term project. We have been going up into Minnesota and Wisconsin previously, where there is an osprey-rich area just kind of northeast of Brainerd in Minnesota. Is one of the spots. And these osprey-rich areas become that way because wherever the young learn to fly and fish is where they return in 3 or 4 years to nest. So by relocating some of these young birds into Iowa, which was previous osprey range, we're essentially reestablishing or rejuvenating a osprey population that was here during European settlement. So it's a long-term sort of project. But this year, we were able to go back up into Minnesota. And we are required to leave one of the young. So they have one or two or three young. And if we target nests that have multiple young, if there's three, quite often that third one in the averages of nature doesn't survive. So we're essentially spreading the population.
Sharing the wealth.
Into a larger distribution, yeah. And if they're ever put under assault, as it was in the 50s and 60s with DDT, I mean, even the osprey-rich areas just about lost their ospreys. They're water-loving creatures. They pretty much eat fish, 99% of their diet.
Oh, yeah, and fish aquatic. Often concentrate those
and then,
pollutants
yeah,
in their
Right,
in
and
their
each fish will have a little bit, but then the fishing eagle or these fishing hawks or fishing ospreys, the native community really refers to them as fish eagles and fish hawks, but we call them ospreys, and they bioaccumulate that
right.
pollutant and a little bit in each fish, and pretty soon you got a problem with reproduction. You know, eggs are breaking, and that's what was occurring back in the 50s and 60s. But they have rebounded, and now we're kind of actively placing them into areas in Iowa that are awesome, are rich with fish, and particularly the northern part of the state.
Okay, let's talk about the actual process by which this happens, because I saw a picture. You had a bucket truck. Well, somebody just goes up in that bucket and...
Yeah, Minnesota Power. I'll kind of work with these birds because they like to put their nests on top of their power transmission lines.
Yeah.
You know, they look for a platform in nature. And typically, it would have been the top of a tree that got twisted out and little platform up there because they're so much wing to these. These birds weigh 3 to 4 pounds, but they're almost as big as an eagle, where an eagle would weigh 11 or 12 pounds. So they're all wing, and they can't deal with branches and things above their nest. So they really kind of helicopter up and down. They look for a platform on a pole or a fishing buoy or those type of nesting opportunities. So a platform on a pole works out well. So the Minnesota Power Company, when they take the nests off of a potential electrocution site, they'll put the nest material on a platform on a pole nearby, and then they're there and life moves on. Well, then there's so many ospreys that they feel like it almost works to their advantage to also have some come to Iowa.
Yeah, so they don't have to keep doing building poles and platforms.
Yeah, so this whole project has partners not only between the states, but with the local county conservation boards. So this year, when the ospreys come to Iowa, we've had about 12 sites, and each time our key partners are with the local county conservation boards. This year, we'll be working with Carroll County, west of here, and also Saragoto County up in Clear Lake. So we have two sites.
How many did you get?
Well, we got five. So we'll have, it was going to be two and three, but there has been another situation that's evolved here in Iowa is there getting on cell phone towers, and sometimes they're 300 feet in the air. And the storm last Sunday caused one of the ospreys, one of two, to get blown out of the cell phone tower. So we have volunteers that are watching these nest sites, and Sunny Nagel from Palo, Iowa, near Cedar Rapids, she went and rescued a little osprey that got blown out of the cell phone tower.
Aww.
So that's quite a story. And they knew about RARE, which is a rehabilitation facility in the Cedar Rapids, Iowa City area. RARE stands for Raptor Advocacy, Rehabilitation, and Education. So they were able to give the bird kind of a clean bill of health, and now that bird is going to be released in Clear Lake. And it's better to go ahead and use it separately, because if we try to take it back to the cell phone tower, the existing one might jump out. They're at that stage now. It takes them about 55 days to fly for the first time. And our osprey population is right about 42 to 44 days.
Okay, so when you take a baby osprey, out of its nest and introduce it into another place. Mm-hmm. I mean, typically it would grow up with its parents teaching it how to live. And so this creates a situation now that you've got to, how do you do that?
At 44 days, the young ospreys have just acquired the ability to tear apart fish on their own. So the adults are just dropping fish at the nest site. Previously, the adults would take a little pinch of fish and feed it to each one of the little guys. And people can still see this going on here in Iowa. But at about 44 days, they can do it. They can feed themselves. So we drop the fish in such a way that they don't imprint on people. And that's the way it'll be for the next 10 days to 2 weeks. And so humans can provide the fish in such a way that they don't imprint on people again. And so it has a lot of volunteer structure. There are a lot of people, osprey stewards, that we've had school children that did some of the fundraising to help with this type of work, particularly around Red Rock and Sailorville back in the day. And those areas now have nesting ospreys. But those kids would come to help feed the birds and be connected to the birds. And we noticed it early on that their whole family would come. Beyond just the kids. So the children were kind of sharing this information and this excitement of this project with their parents. And lo and behold, now we have people, the children that helped initially, now at Cerro Gordo County, there's going to be a couple people that are going to bring their children. So this long-term sort of strategy has some multiplier effect going on.
You were saying that you were telling me earlier that the children are doing some of the fishing. They fish for the bluegills and...
Yeah, they share. We ask them to go out, and they did a lot of that type of work over at White Rock Conservancy. It was one of our 12 other sites. And kids would go fishing and get bluegills from a lot of the ponds around the Garst area there at White Rock Conservancy and Carroll County. And so they'd share their bluegills. And so that was for the fish for the 44-day-old ospreys when they arrived. Gosh, that's been about 10 years ago now. Hmm. So it's it's exciting. I might point out that we got involved with the osprey work, particularly in Northwest Iowa, because it was never documented as a native species in Iowa. The European settlers, to all their credit, they had a misconception that if we get rid of the ospreys, there'll be more fish. And that was kind of the mantra as a civilization swept across Iowa. So they were essentially taken out before anybody ever documented that they were actively nesting here. So to kind of keep everything in a time frame reference, there are, Spirit Lake, there's a lot of ponds, a lot of lakes, Sailorville. There's on the habitat of Iowa, there's a large lake. Opportunities weren't there historically. So particularly in Northwest Iowa, we asked the chief of the Yankton Nation, Lauren Zephyr, Golden Light Eagle, is it appropriate to try to bring these birds back? And he got back with me the next day and said, well, we did lodge and we were in ceremony. And just to let you know, the eagles are going to welcome these ospreys to return. And the hawks are going to welcome these ospreys to return. And the message was clear. Put them in the headwaters of the watersheds and allow them to help you with your pollution issues. So they become our ambassadors for clean water. So the Yankton Nation felt particularly that this was something they wanted to embrace and assist. So that's how we've forged this alliance. The partnership grew to the Native community that essentially were a part of Northwest Iowa for millennia, for tens of thousands
of years.
It's so
interesting to me that you consulted with the chief this.
Yeah, we knew we could do the biology. We had a lot of expertise in that from other areas. A lot of the osprey work initially happened around the Chesapeake Bay and in Pennsylvania. But when it came to Iowa, we knew we could do the biology. But it was the missing link was that, but will we honor their presence again, or will we just will a future generation not take them as what has been invested with this work up to this time, all these kids? So now we were essentially growing an advocacy group that would at some point realized that the species like ospreys that are an indicator of the health of our environment, that we need to have these birds in place. And so the work proceeded almost with that spiritual acceptance, or so that hopefully we could do the biology, but I kind of turned that spiritual component over to the Yankton Nation, and it seemed to be working well. We had our first successful nest in Spirit Lake in 2003, and then in 2012 we got a second, and now it looks like in 2016 we're going to have as many as four. And the only thing better than a nesting pair of ospreys is the second nesting pair, but we really strive for about three or four, so they have multiple young of six or seven each year, and that'll be a self-sustaining osprey project into the future.
Oh, you mean the osprey will have two cycles of kids
I meant
each year?
The second nesting pair.
Okay.
They're a social bird, so it's nice to have.
Oh.
You have one pair. It's just only the start. You need three or four or five.
To have a community.
A community, and that's what we've fortunate is happening in Dickinson County near Spirit Lake, and also in Des Moines. There's about six nesting pairs there. We've got some placements coming up. These young birds are going to be able to be placed in these release structures in Carroll County early on Friday morning. And then Friday about noon, we're going to be in Clear Lake. So that's, what is that? That'll be June 22nd. We're placing the birds and the people that are helping up there, and it's kind of exciting. And then on Saturday, coming up, Colfax, Iowa, right on Interstate 80. Here's the beauty of what's happening there. They're dedicating two new water areas that were previously a sand mine, and Martin Marietta basically donated over 400 acres to the city of Colfax. Last year, lo and behold, Jasper County was included in our osprey expansion. They had a nesting pair, and then in the spring there's a second nesting pair. So they're going to
celebration is in order.
So we're going to be there. They're going to have hot dogs at 11:30, and then a program at noon about the ospreys and their new area. So the ospreys are really shining the light. We're going to do some good on habitat, and they're stewards of clean water. So.
Can you repeat the time and date of that event in Colfax?
Yeah, that's going to be 11:30 on July 23rd, Saturday. There's a cookout and then a program afterwards. And part of the program will be celebrating these ospreys. And it's going to be a little early for the young to be fledging, but there's two nesting pairs. And they're kind of distant from any of the release sites. So it's showing of the 24 or 25 nesting pairs we know about, it's starting to spread. So that's pretty exciting. And thanks for your interest in the osprey topic.
Oh, Pat, you provide us so much inspiration. Thank you for your work and for your reporting. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have a quick music break and come back with a poet who's all into the birds.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I ran out.
Like a bird on the wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free. Like a worm on a hook, like a knight from some old-fashioned book, I have saved all my ribbons for thee. If I have been unkind, I hope that you can just let it go by. If I have been untrue, I hope you know it was never to you. Oh, like a bird on the wire, like a drunk in a midnight my way to be free.
That's poet and songwriter, musician Leonard Cohen, and you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, and with us is another poet, a Nevada poet, Jennifer L. Knox, who has, Jennifer, you have a special crowdsourced poem project called Bird of Mouth.
Iowa Bird of Mouth.
Iowa Bird of Mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And that got funded by?
That was funded by, it's been funded by the Iowa Council for the Arts, Iowa Arts Council, and the National Endowment for the Arts.
My.
I know.
And what is a crowdsourced poetry project?
A crowdsourced poem, in our case, it's going to take place online. Anyone can contribute to it. And that's what really drew me to the idea of crowdsourced poetry, that you don't need to be a published writer. A classroom can get together and create a verse for this poem and it's going to look like almost like a comment field.
A comment field.
Going to look like a comment field but there won't be any names attached to it, but it's going to have a contributors list. So that if you want, you can add your name to the contributors list, but names will not be attached to the verses in the poem itself. You can add one word. You can add up to 300 words a day. And you can add to it all month long. And every month, the spotlight bird is going to change. And I've been working with Tyler Harms, who is in charge of Iowa Youth Birders. You know Tyler? He's so awesome. I met him at the farmer's market, and I had just gotten the go-ahead for the grant, and I said, Iowa Young Birders, tell me about that. And he, with all of his knowledge, he helped us create the list of the spotlight birds per month. So in September, we're going to start with the goldfinch.
Oh, great.
October, ring-necked pheasant. November, the American crow. December, the eastern screech owl. January, the bald eagle. February, the northern cardinal. March, red-winged blackbird. That's going to be so much fun. April, the trumpeter swan, which apparently is as I'm sure the osprey will be, a conservation success story.
It's working real well. Their population has been rejuvenated to about 50 nesting pairs around Iowa now.
Not bad. Yeah. Not bad. May, the American robin. June, the eastern bluebird. July, the eastern meadowlark. And next August, the great blue heron.
Oh, my.
So every month or every day, anyone all over the world can log in and add their voice to this ongoing, changing poem that is meant to encapsulate as many voices as possible, meant to take that in.
Wow. So it is just going to be one poem, not 12.
It will be 12 different poems, 12 different birds, but all of them will live on the Iowa Bird of Mouth website, so you can go and see what people have written about the goldfinch and when you're writing about the ring-necked pheasant.
And then you have a Facebook page as well.
Yes, we have a group where people will be able to post. We really want sound files. Photographs that they take. This is great for Iowa Young Birders. This can be a repository for
inspiration.
Yes, absolutely. To incorporate Pat was talking about the spiritual element. This is the artistic element of birding and sort of record how birds unite us because of their ability to exist in so many different habitats. That they move through cities and urban environments, and that we can capture that. We could take pictures of it, sound files. We can write songs about it and post them on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. It's very exciting.
Yeah, it's... Yeah.
The birds spin their magic.
They do.
Once you get it established, once you're there in their environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that word spin, being a fiber artist, because, you know, it's about this thread of continuity.
It is a thread of continuity, absolutely.
And so I hate to be Debbie Downer, but,
sure.
You know, what about people who are just out there to, you know, muck things up? What if they add their comments to the thing? Are you going to be able to remove stuff?
We can remove things. There's a no profanity rule on the site. We don't want to censor anyone, but we also want to make this a space that is about birds and knowing that these words are going to endure. It's open source, so anyone can use this work to create music, to create other poems, to create visual art, to create fiber art. So once you contribute to that, it is it should be a meaningful experience. So if somebody's out there just, you know, typing junk, we will the filters will be high for profanity, and we can pull it.
Okay, good.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, how did you come up with this idea?
I have no idea. I really
have
no idea.
Nested in your brain. And...
well, actually, Juan Felipe Herrera, who's the poet laureate, is doing a crowdsourced poetry project. I took the format from him, from his poetry project La Familia, which is on the Library of Congress website. And he has a different topic every month, and hundreds and thousands of people have contributed to this poem about family, different aspects of family. Classrooms have contributed their words in a day. Individual students. It's just so exciting.
You're going to be busy. Those teachers are going to call you in and ask you to.
I'm thinking about making a video for it so that they can just show that. But teachers and classrooms are really what my goal. It goes live September 1st. Between now and then, to talk to teachers and to talk to students and conservation organizations, art organizations. I love the idea of Native communities. That would just be so much fun. My mother is 84, and she spends a lot of time at Heartland Senior Services, so organizations like that, to get the word out to them and to show them how to use the site and tell them the purpose of it, how it unites us as conservationists and sort of gives people a place to be creative.
And this all starts in September?
September 1st. Mm-hmm. We'll have the website up before then so people can explore it, but it will go live. The poem, the Goldfinch poem, will open up on September 1st. And then that will close at the end of September, and Ringneck Pheasant will open up October 1st.
Okay. Well, anything else you'd like to say about your crowdsourced poetry project, Jennifer Knox?
Join the Facebook group. About every week we have news going up, and you can start adding to the community now with songs, photographs. We're on Instagram, Twitter. Join us and add to the project. It's open for business.
All right. I can't wait to get involved.
Good, good.
Put some words out there.
Cool.
All right. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started out the show with a talk by Des Moines Waterworks Director Bill Stowe at the Ames Public Library on Monday, also hearing from Evan Berger, the Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement organizer. Then our summer intern, Isaac Beal, brought us the story of Pokemon Go with an interview of Tate Hugstadt. Wildlife correspondent Pat Schlarbaum told us about his forays into Minnesota to fetch us back some osprey chicks, and Nevada poet Jennifer L. Knox gave us the scoop on her crowdsourced poetry project, Bird of Mouth. Stay tuned for that, and thank you to all of our guests and correspondents. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on our show postings in your news feed. Thanks to webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by Jonah DeGeest. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was by Leonard Cohen. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878 or through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.